From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, more arrests in the Marathon bombing case, the Red Line and Syria, Obama in Mexico, more jobs. On Syria, a cautious President Obama in Mexico City yesterday said, let's look before we leap into the Syrian conflict.
We want to make sure that we look before we leap, and that what we're doing is actually helpful to the situation as opposed to making it more deadly or more complex.
Three classmates have accused Boston bomber Jahar Tsarnaev, arrested for covering up afterward. The attorney for one, Dias Kabarnaev of Kazakhstan, said his client did not connect the dots.
He did not know that this individual was involved in the bombing. His first inkling came much later. The government allegations, as far as that he saw a photo and recognized him immediately, we dispute.
And gun vote recoil after the Senate killed wider background checks on gun buyers. Erica Lafferty, whose mother was the principal killed at Sandy Hook Elementary School, went to a town hall in New Hampshire to confront Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte, asking why the burden of background checks was more important than the burden of her mother being gunned down at school.
I'm just wondering why the burden of my mother being gunned down in the hall of her elementary school isn't as important as that.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Dina Temple Raston from NPR, Juliet Alperin from The Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends, yes or no, on Syrian intervention, on more gun debate, on the morning after pill changes. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington is Juliet Alperin, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Juliet, great to have you with us again.
Thanks, Tom.
And from New York is Dina Temple Raston, counterterrorism correspondent for NPR. Dina, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Juliet, and Dina.
Juliet, take us right to Mexico. The president there talking with the relatively new Mexican president. What's at the top of his agenda on this trip for Mexico and Central America, Juliet?
Well, interestingly, the president is there primarily to focus on the economy, about basically look at the very close economic ties that the United States has with Mexico, and also to make the argument that the better Mexicans are doing economically, the fewer problems we're going to have with immigration. And of course, immigration does come up. We're in this debate. But what President Obama emphasized, particularly in his press conference earlier this week and also yesterday after his arrival, is that he wants this hemisphere to have a strong economy that applies to both Mexico and Costa Rica, which is also on his travel agenda, and that he wants to emphasize that part as opposed to kind of the downside that you often hear when politicians are talking about it.
The drumbeat in advance of his trip had a lot to do with Mexico becoming less cooperative in the war on drug traffic across that U.S.-Mexico border. Here's a little tape of the president in Mexico yesterday saying the U.S. and Mexico still working together to cooperate, but that things are evolving.
I agreed to continue our close cooperation on security, even as the nature of that cooperation will evolve. As I told the president, it is obviously up to the Mexican people to determine their security structures and how it engages with other nations, including the United States.
Juliet, is it clear that there are now instructions from Mexico City to their drug enforcement people, and there are a lot of different agencies and even military involved in that, to step back from the tighter cooperation that had emerged with the United States, Juliet?
Well, it looks like there is going to be centralization. That's what they're talking about, that they, rather than having kind of these individual agencies, they want to centralize it and have it go through one part of the Mexican government. And that certainly has raised some concerns, this idea that you really want people in the trenches who have relationships with individuals to be able to talk directly to their Mexican counterparts rather than go through federal government headquarters. So there is some concern about that.
There was, for example, we read, Mexican officials were undergoing lie detector tests by Americans to see if they were dealing with Mexican officials who were not themselves corrupt. Word is that that is now ending or being sharply curtailed, Juliet. What does this bode for genuine, good cooperation? You know, a word like centralization can cover a whole lot of shenanigans.
Absolutely.
If it's not well-intentioned.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things that's very interesting, and actually I covered, the new president in Mexico is actually from the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which held power for decades and decades before.
And they're
actually
back.
And they're back. So and so what's very interesting is they certainly were widely seen as having corruption problems, as collaborating with drug traffickers. And it was actually PAN, the National Action Party, which is more conservative, that had come in and really championed this war on drugs in a way that you hadn't seen under the PRI. And so I think one of the real concerns is, you know, are we seeing, you know, with Peña Nieto, are we seeing kind of a return to the old politics? And so while certainly you're not going to have the president criticizing a new Mexican president on this front, people are going to be looking very carefully again. Years ago in the early 90s, I was there reporting, and at that point there was widespread collaboration between the PRI and drug cartels. And so that's what people are watching for.
Security issues, drug issues on the border there. Dina Temple-Raston, bring security issues even closer to home, especially for us here in Boston. Interesting developments this week with the arrest of three former classmates of Jihar Tsarnaev, who, of course, is charged in the Boston bombing, not with planning, not with carrying out, but with help covering up afterward. What are the implications of this, Dina? Is this a big deal, or is this, you know, college buddies just not tuned in enough to the law and their obligations after a bombing?
Well, if you actually read the criminal complaint against them, it looks like they panicked when they suddenly realized that their friend may in fact be implicated in the bombing. What they grabbed was a backpack that was full of empty fireworks canisters, and they basically tossed the backpack and they grabbed his laptop as well. I think what's going to end up happening is they're going to look a little bit hapless when this finally comes to court about the way they didn't really try to cover anything up. They didn't, for example, take the backpack, put it in the car, and drive it to a dumpster that was further away. They drove it to a They basically put it in a garbage bag and threw it in the trash. So I think what's interesting about this is that we know from talking to law enforcement officials that there was somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 12 people that they had been wanting to talk to or tracking in some way that they think had something to do with this plot, that, or at least had a role before or after the plot. And these three men, or young college students, they're all 19 years old, had a role after the plot, but they have been very careful to say that they had nothing to do beforehand.
But it makes the world very small, Jack. I mean, we're hearing now from the father of one of them, Dias Kadyrbayev, and he's talking with Kazakhstan's Channel 7, we're going to take tape from here. This is really reaching way out into the world. But here's his father saying that his son called him, said he had no idea that Jihar would be involved in anything like this. Here's Russian television, or Kazakh television, describing those remarks from his father.
He says his son said, "Daddy, we didn't know. He's not the kind of guy who would hurt anyone. He was very kind, very chatty. We were shocked."
They're describing Jihar Tsarnaev, who, of course, is charged in the bombings that killed and maimed and led to so much loss of life and limb. I mean, Jack, how do you look at this? Dina Temple-Raston says not exactly a cover-up. On the other hand, you take the backpack, you put it in the dumpster. That is hardly bringing it forward to the authorities in a time when a serious crime had just taken place.
Indeed, and a more serious one, or an equally serious one, was about to take place. You know, if you look at that timeline, I'm not exactly clear on it, but I think you could make a case that if they had come forward with their suspicions, I think on Thursday afternoon, as soon as they had them, perhaps Officer Sean Collier would not have been murdered. That's, to me, the really awful part of this. Their careless, well, we'll go and cover up for our friend, has a kind of fatal tone to it when you just look at the time. And I think that, you know, we're already hearing people saying, and I think Senator McCain even said this week, let's take a look at this immigration reform bill and see if there's something we can do here about, people staying over time on their visas, as I think a couple of these students had, and cracking down on that. So, but it's a tormenting thought that if they had come forward, perhaps perhaps another death would have been avoided.
Dina Temple-Raston, all over the country now, these three young faces staring out at us, two from Kazakhstan, one here in this country. And the question of how they could have taken this lightly enough not to report to authorities. Now, this was a buddy, but here with everybody talking about self-radicalization, influences from all over the world, Jahar and his brother watching Anwar al-Awlaki on the web with his message of global jihad. Does it look to you as though American authorities are being tough here to send a message, we're not going to put up with this?
Well, I think that the three young men clearly appear to have had some sort of role afterwards, and they'll be held to account for that. I mean, there's another thing that happens in arresting what may be Jahar Tsarnaev's best friends, is it puts pressure on him to talk more as well. And I think that in bringing his friends in, arresting them, letting him know that they've been arrested, maybe they'll get some more cooperation from Jahar. So there are many sort of threads being pulled here simultaneously, and I think that this isn't the last of the arrests that we'll be seeing in this. I think that law enforcement officials are becoming increasingly convinced that this was not some grand conspiracy directed from overseas. They just aren't finding those connections either in Russia or here in this country. So it does beg the question, has the kind of radicalization that we have in this country, the kind of radicalization, frankly, we've been worried about for years, the self-radicalization without any help from overseas, has that finally come to roost?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, more arrests in Boston, the red line in Syria, the president in Mexico, the morning after pill, and more. Dina Temple-Raston is with us, counterterrorism correspondent for NPR. Juliet Eilprin is here, White House reporter for The Washington Post, and Jack Beatty. Dina, I want to ask you about the picture before these arrests were made of the two young men from Kazakhstan and the one American, three friends of Jahar Tsarnaev, early this week. Before that, the conversation over the weekend was about how well the FBI and others had followed up on signs that there might be something going on here. I've got tape here from Representative Peter King, Republican from New York, talking with NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday about his concerns, he said, on the bombing investigation and before, said he was concerned that the FBI isn't working well with other organizations. Here's King.
I think it's important to know, are there other people involved in this threat? Are there others that are still out there, family members or people in the community? That's very important to find out. Also, what did cause them to be radicalized? Was it done here? Was it done overseas? Was it done over the Internet? What caused that to happen? How can we stop it in the future? Also ask why the FBI is not cooperating more with law enforcement, why they did not give vital evidence to the NYPD about another possible attack.
A couple of angles there, but Dina, first to this issue of the potential for more arrests. I think you mentioned it as well. What net is out there? In what direction is the hopper still open?
Well, I'm not entirely sure exactly who it is that they're looking for, but apparently these two young men, Tamerlan Tsarnaev and Jahar Tsarnaev, had lots of friends and lots of connections in the Boston area. And so they have to sort of run each one of these to ground to see if there is any connection with these friends or these acquaintances and what happened in Boston during the marathon. And that's what they're looking at. In particular, I know that they're looking very carefully at Tamerlan's wife, Catherine Russell. The New York Times reported this morning that her DNA, there was female DNA found on a bomb fragment, and it is not a match with Catherine Russell. But she has stopped cooperating with authorities, according to the people that I've spoken with, and that's made them wonder if maybe there's something there.
Jack, lots of people's attention grabbed by the reporting today that before he stopped talking, after being read his Miranda rights, apparently, Jahar Tsarnaev had indicated that he and his brother had intended these bombs for July 4th in Boston, a very big gathering along the river there with all the great fireworks and symphony and all the rest. But they had the bomb done. There was Patriots Day and Marathon Day, so let's do it now. Kind of a, whatever, let's do it now makes me very uneasy just how casual it was in a way.
Oh, the whole thing had this larky sense to it, you know, and of course the Esplanade concert right there on the Charles, you know, as storied an event.
Iconic,
Yes, as quintessential a Boston event as the marathon, and they planned to do something. I mean, it's just... there's something just that fundamental. You can't work your way inside these minds. I mean, something just stops you. Some pathology, some hatred, some ignorance, whatever it is. It's a revolting sort of regress to try to even imagine the kinds of things they were thinking. And this young man, the younger brother, who just clearly was just sort of gave over his autonomy, it seems, to the older brother. I mean, what a pathetic character he cuts.
And yet this idea of self-radicalization, if that's what's going on here, what has gone on here, is something everybody's going to have to pay attention to. Let's bring our listeners in. Ben in Newport, New Hampshire. Ben, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I mean, I can't get over your expert saying self-radicalization may be here. I mean, what about Colonel Liddell? It's been here. If the media and this administration had realized that or would admit it, I mean, Colonel Liddell was self-radicalized. It was terrorism. The administration wants to call it workplace violence, not terrorism. I mean, if they stop being quite so politically correct, they might realize what's going on and be able to have started looking at things like this years ago.
Yeah, I appreciate your call, Ben. Nadal Hassan in the Fort Hood shooting, and of course, he also had been in what looked like a closer relationship with Anwar al-Awlaki.
Right.
It's not as though, Dina, that Washington isn't paying attention to this. I mean, after all, they took out the drones and killed al-Awlaki and his son.
Well, and Samir Khan, the one who was the editor of Inspire magazine, from which possibly the Tsarnaev brothers got their recipe for the bombs. I should just jump in for a second here and say that there is a difference between Nidal Hassan and the Fort Hood shooting and what appears to be the connection between al-Awlaki and the Tsarnaev brothers. Being that al-Awlaki has been long dead by the time the Tsarnaev brothers were watching his videos. They did not correspond with him. They didn't ask him for his approval for a mission. None of that happened. That makes it very different from the Nidal Hassan case, in which Nidal Hassan was actually asking for advice and sanctioning. And another case, the Abdulmutallab case, remember the underwear bomber in 2009
yes.
on the Detroit plane? He also was actually sent by al-Awlaki to do that particular suicide mission. So I think that there is a nuanced distinction, but there is a distinction if these young men had no contact with anyone else sanctioning them or goading them and just found it within themselves. That's a slightly turned page in this idea of self-radicalization in the United States.
Yes, we see the distinction there in the turn of the screw. I mean, I take your point, Ben, but look, this is interesting. I'm here. Al-Awlaki is long gone at this point. Intentionality in reaching out, if it's there, it's reaching to us even out of the grave. But the videos online stay there, and they're available, Juliet Alperin, to anybody who wants to watch them, including anybody in this country. Now, how keenly do you see the White House worried about this issue of discontented young people in this country looking out at the world and turning to sources of inspiration, even like a dead encourager of jihadi?
They are worried. And just to follow up, one point I want to make is that it's not like U.S. officials have not been worried about this for years. And in fact, one thing I know that's interesting that goes back several years is they had been collaborating with British authorities who obviously have issues with self-radicalization in Britain among immigrants, and that had been seen as a bigger problem for Britain than the U.S., and they've been studying, for example, certain communities, for example, around the Detroit area to see is there that potential there and things like that. So this has been on the radar screen for quite a while, I think. As Dina's pointing out, this is the moment where we're seeing kind of concrete evidence in a way that we haven't before. But it's certainly something that they're worried about. But it's very hard to track. I mean, you can't know everyone who you're going to monitor on the internet and things like that. So I think part of the problem is it's just such an amorphous one that poses a huge challenge for intelligence authorities and for the White House.
Let's go to Marguerite in Melrose, Massachusetts. Marguerite, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was so interested in what the young man would be saying after that terrible bombing, the survivor of the two of them. And he was mentioning the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan. And then the judge came in and read him his rights to be quiet until he had his lawyer. But it's too bad that there wasn't more chance to talk about that, because quite a few people have been worried about that since we've had the terrible five-year war in Iraq, when we killed, of course, thousands of children. And that you had a young man here to talk about that, then he was cut off right away, talking about why he did this and who was with him.
Yeah, the motivation question is interesting when you get more specific on it. Of course, much more than 5 years in Iraq. Dina, these interrogations are always interesting in this way. What we are told about what they hear from Jahar or anybody in that circumstance presumably is highly edited. I mean, they have a complete leeway in what they tell us about what he's said. There has not been that much of detail said, at least that I've seen, about him describing in a more up-close, intimate way their motivation, Dina.
Well, and much of what he has told officials, let me first say that before he was Mirandized, he was actually interviewed for 50 minutes, so almost a whole hour. And under the public safety exemption to reading someone his rights, you basically have to ask questions that are not about the crime itself, but instead questions that have something to do with public safety. So are there other bombs? Are there other conspirators here? Mm-hmm. Do we need to worry about the public having another bomb go off? That sort of thing. And I think that we're going to find out a lot more about motivation here. I just Iraq and Afghanistan being their motivation just doesn't ring true to me, or as you say, is very edited because, frankly, the U.S. has pulled out of Iraq and it's pulling out of Afghanistan. And these I've done many, many of these stories on these terrorism plots, and they're not usually this retrospective. They're usually, you know, something ongoing.
But in the global kind of jihadi communication realm, aren't those still cited as American war on Islam?
Right, but that's different than American war in Iraq and Afghanistan specifically. That's why I just think this doesn't quite ring true. If what he said is, we did this because we're fighting for Muslims all over the world, that would be much more in keeping with the sort of narrative that we see in these kinds of radicalizations. And the other thing about self-radicalization, in Britain, it actually is very different because in Britain, there are a whole host of people there who have traveled and trained in camps in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And we don't have that same problem here. Britain thinks there are literally 3,000 people who have trained in camps and come back to Britain. In our case, in the United States, the numbers are paltry. And in terms of self-radicalization in Detroit, what actually has been happening very much, there's a Somali community that's been having in Minneapolis that turned out to be the most radicalizing community in this country. There were between 17 and 21 young Somali men who went to go and fight in Somalia for a group called Al-Shabaab, which has links to Al-Qaeda. That's where authorities have been watching very carefully. Less so Detroit. In Detroit, they have a very integrated community there that sort of watchdogs itself. So this hasn't been a huge issue.
If I could just, what actually the point is that what I was trying to make, just to clarify, is that British authorities were looking, because there hadn't been radicalization in Detroit, so they were looking at why has that not been a problem there where it has been.
Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
So
yes, exactly.
That's all I'm saying, is that they had been trying to trade information to see how to address it, but partially just for that reason that it hasn't been a problem.
I mean, it's interesting and unsettling in a way that you don't have to be involved in a jihadi training camp, that we still don't know fully about Chechen and Dagestan, but you don't, in perhaps in this case, you don't have that kind of involvement, and you still have a deadly attack. I want to look past Iraq and Afghanistan for a moment to Syria. That has had a big workout this week after last week's word on chemical weapons use, kind of maybe asserted by the White House and the Pentagon after Israel and France and Britain were talking about it. Over the weekend, here was Mike Rogers, Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee on ABC's This Week, saying American inaction in response to Syria's rumored or alleged use of chemical weapons could have big implications.
The president has laid down the line. He, you know, it can't be a dotted line. It can't be anything other than a red line. And more than just Syria, Iran is paying attention to this. North Korea is paying attention to this. So I think the options aren't huge, but some action needs to be taken.
Action needs to be taken, says the Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. But then out came the president for his press conference on Tuesday, and we'll talk about that more broadly. But here was President Obama saying that although there is, quote, evidence that chemical weapons have been used inside of Syria, he was urging caution and said he still needed all the facts.
If we end up rushing to judgment without hard, effective evidence, then we can find ourselves in a position where we can't mobilize the international community to support what we do. There may be objections even among some people in the region who are sympathetic with the opposition if we take action. It's important for us to do this in a prudent way.
Be prudent. Don't rush to judgment. And Juliet, then, out of Mexico City, the president we heard in there saying, look before you leap. Where does the White House stand at this point, Juliet? There's talk of maybe arms to particular rebels in Syria, but nothing clear on that. What's the latest?
Well, frankly, the latest is that we're in a little bit of a limbo because whether it's the president or then, you know, the next day, Jay Carney, his spokesman, and then he reiterates, they just simply won't say what they're going to do. They just say that that obviously they have come up with different scenarios, which they refuse to outline, and that they're not ruling in or out military intervention at this point. And so that's just what you heard. I mean, again, in that press conference, when that's kind of the most we've heard from the president about it, he talked about, we don't know who used these chemical weapons. We don't know exactly how much. He was emphasizing the uncertainty and using that to basically punt on the question of what exactly they're going to do on this issue.
But his own defense secretary, Chuck Hagel, put it on the table last week with his very ambiguous assertion that there had been chemical weapons used, and plenty of people willing, ready to jump on that. Arizona Republican Senator John McCain telling NPR's Renee Montagne just this morning, the U.S. needs to consider limited military action in Syria as soon as possible. Here's McCain.
Every day it gets worse. There's approximately 100,000 people fighting in Syria. About 6,000 or more are these jihadists. But having said that, they're the best fighters, they're the best trained, they're the best experienced, and they're not afraid to die. So every day that goes by that we don't provide the assistance, then the more difficult and complicated the situation will be once Bashar Assad leaves.
Jack Beattie, I'm still trying to make sense of the Obama administration move last week, putting chemical weapons, the assertion out there that there was use when they had already drawn the red line, and now we're in this murky sort of no man's land of where we go from here. Why do you think that was put out? Because it was true? And if it's true, where's the follow-up? If it was, you know, only half known, why put it out there? Where do you see us standing here, Jack?
I think they had a congressional imperative there, that this was something, a report they owed to Congress. They had to come forward with it, and so perhaps they got the report out before they had their ducks in a row. But the ducks are today, even as we sort of look at it, being pulled back. Already the British Defense Secretary, Philip Hammond, he made a statement yesterday basically saying, the confidence that we are seeking in these samples degrades over time, and in order to have a properly measured chain of custody, we'd need to obtain samples after, quote, another incident. Well, here are the British, who were taking the lead on this just last week, saying, oh, yes, we have proof, we have seen. Now the British Defense Secretary is saying, well, we may need another incident in order to confirm this. Suddenly, the brakes have been put on, I think, both here and abroad, almost as if the British ourselves have suddenly seen, wait a minute, do we really want to get into what Aaron David Miller, the U.S. foreign policy expert, calls the trap of Syria?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, hundreds of thousands of demonstrators gathered in cities around the world on May 1st, May Day, to call for workers' rights. In Seattle, protests turned violent as police used flash bombs and pepper spray to disperse the crowd.
Get back! Get back! Get back!
Grief and anger and arrests in Bangladesh after the big garment factory building collapsed. They're a huge death toll. One survivor said that the workers saw it coming.
We saw cracks in the building the day before it fell, she says, and we complained. But bosses told us if we didn't return to work, we wouldn't get paid.
And the music world lost two talents this week. Chris Kelly, half of the 1990s kid rap duo Criss Cross, died at age 34. And the guitarist for the 1980s metal band Slayer, Jeff Hanneman, died at 49. His opening to Raining Blood, one of the most recognized guitar riffs in heavy metal. Looking at a week in the news, more arrests in Boston, the red line in Syria, the president in Mexico, the morning after pill with Dina Temple-Raston of NPR, Juliet Alperin, Washington Post's White House correspondent, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's get a couple callers here. Anne in Middlesex, Vermont. Anne, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm curious about why I keep hearing whenever any newscast comes up about Syria and our potential involvement there that there's no discussion about the potential of our allies also being involved. At least before Bush invaded Iraq, the fall before that, he was going around to trying to find support for, anyway, I'm just wondering.
For an alliance in Iraq, or we saw it in Libya as well. I mean, it may be because they don't want to go down that road, but Juliet, let me bring that to you. Maybe the president just doesn't want to have an alliance up and ready to go, or maybe it's not there this time. This is a very fraught and complicated environment. What do you say, Juliet?
Well, it's true that he's not pushing for this broad global alliance, but it's not as if we aren't coordinating very closely, as John mentioned, with Britain, with France, with Canada. So certainly there are a number of our closest allies are coordinating with us, are consulting, and so it's not as if the U.S. would be going it alone. But we're not talking about that kind of coalition of the willing of bringing in every country in the world to deal with this. Partially because again, we are not talking about an invasion. That's simply not on the table. And so that's not what's being contemplated. And so you're not going to see the kind of diplomacy in the run-up to military intervention that would have that same form as we saw.
And George in Worcester, Massachusetts. George, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you see?
I see Obama is very correct regarding Syria. I think he should take his time because we all know what happened 2000. When George Bush has all report about the uranium from Niger and all this accusation and false report. Back then, the British, Saddam Hussein has a weapon. Everybody thought he had nothing. And, everybody knows this stuff. I think we have short-term memory regarding politics here in this country. And I have to add one more thing regarding the Syria problem right now. We really, if we're going to really encourage Arabic Spring or democracy or wouldn't have to go too far to go to Saudi Arabia. There's the most dictated country on the planet. The women, they cannot even ride their own car. I mean, they can't see their own brothers. So are we really supporting freedom and democracy in the world here?
Well, George, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Jack, I mean, lots of people writing in online about this. BHA says, no. We need to stop thinking we are the world's police force. But Jack, what about the case that McCain makes? Of course, he's made cases before, but that the direction of this is going to be a problem sooner or later. It's going to end up in the U.S. lap. What do you say, Jack?
Well, that position, Senator McCain, Senator Lindsey Graham, their view that we should intervene not with troops on the ground, but no-fly zones and that sort of thing, only about 25% of the public wants that. There's a strong feeling that the public wants no involvement. So the president, I think, is cautious politically because that's where the public is. But beyond that, when you start to look at the possibilities of any kind of intervention, say you arm the rebels. Well, this week I saw someone pointing out that suppose they get the rebels get shoulder heat-seeking missiles.
To bring down aircraft, yeah.
Yes, well, someone pointed out, would the Israeli civilian airliner El Al ever be safe again? That was a question asked in Israel. Well, of course it wouldn't be. And
with the pipeline from Syria to Hezbollah to who knows where.
Yes, yes. And now, of course, we won't give them that. We may give them something else, something to anti-tank weapons. Well, will that be enough? Well, perhaps it won't be. So then you get into the escalating spiral. But it's when you start to look at these things that the damage to real U.S. interests, Israel, stability in the region, and then simply the possibility that these weapons of mass destruction, the sarin, the other things, that could get into the hands of al-Nusra. I mean, that is just, know, that's a horrifying scenario. And I think the administration is, well, the public seems to think they are very wise to be very cautious.
Though caution may not bring an ideal outcome either.
No,
Steve in Brattleboro, Vermont. Steve, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom and distinguished panel. I would really like to get your opinions on what's going on at Guantanamo. Here we have a moral tragedy. I mean, it's so clear that most of the people being held there, at least dozens, are cleared and ready to go. We have a hunger strike going on where people are giving up their last vestiges of life in an attempt to kind of make a statement about the fact that they're being held illegally for over a decade. We have a brutal force of tubes up their noses and into their stomachs in very kind of painful ways. And yet, even though the president has said something about it, I would not be surprised a year from now that we'll have some more dead bodies or we'll have some more wrecked lives. But in fact, we're talking about the war on terror. And then you kind of put this kind of point up that, in fact, but we don't care about life at a certain level if, in fact, you've already categorized it as useless people who we accidentally picked up, you know, when the war on terror supposedly began. So I'd really like to see what the panel has to say about that.
Steve, we'll go to it right now. I appreciate your call. Let's just get the president in there. Of course, at his press conference at the White House on Tuesday, he talked about it. Though it was not quite clear what the talk was supposed to suggest in terms of action. Here's the president Tuesday.
It is not a surprise to me that we've got problems in Guantanamo, which is why when I was campaigning in 2007 and 2008, and when I was elected in 2008, I said we need to close Guantanamo. I continue to believe that we've got to close Guantanamo.
I continue to believe that we've got to close Guantanamo. Juliet Alpern, you cover the White House. The president said that, but what does that mean? He's said that ever since before he was first elected.
It's a very good point. Well, I think what it does show and what is interesting is that, for example, this was really the only news that came out of the press conference that he said that he would try to fight to close it, that he would launch another effort to do that, which again has been unsuccessful. It speaks to the president's biggest problem, Republicans in Congress, who have resisted him on so many fronts, including this one. And it's very unclear when he struggles to pass things with real broad bipartisan backing in the country, such as gun control, when he's working on the budget and immigration, whether he really can both, you know, muster the interest on Capitol Hill to grapple with this. So clearly it is something that actually he as a constitutional lawyer cares about, but whether he can deliver seems much less likely.
Dina, I mean, it is a bad situation down there, and we're going to talk more about this on Monday, about the Guantanamo situation. But as our caller said, they're feeding hunger strikers with tubes forced down their nose, you know, dripping Ensure into their bellies to keep them alive. 86 out of 166 detainees there have been cleared to be transferred out of there, but they're not going anywhere. In terms of counterterrorism, Dina, what's the significance of Guantanamo at this point? Is it helping? Is it hurting? Does it matter?
Well, I also cover Guantanamo for National Public Radio, and I've been covering the military commission's trials down there for about a year now. Mm-hmm. And there's a change in tone and tenor in the prison down at Guantanamo, and I think that's why we're seeing this hunger strike now. There are 100 of the 166 detainees who are on a hunger strike, and there are various reasons why they chose to do this now. But one of the reasons why they did is detainees told guards that they felt they had been forgotten. There was a hopelessness to their plight there. And in particular, because President Obama didn't mention Guantanamo in either his State of the Union address or in his inaugural address. And one thing that's interesting about that is that these detainees are clearly watching the news from down there in Guantanamo. They used to have sort of a communal living system. And just recently, there's been a turnover in who's in charge of the prison there, and they've now put them all in individual cells. Another thing that has led to this sort of feeling of hopelessness down at Guantanamo. You know, one of the things that President Obama said when he talked about closing Guantanamo is that it has become, or it is, a big rallying point for recruitment. It's one more injustice that many of these young radical extremist Muslim young men point to as another reason why the U.S. seems to be drawing a bead on Muslims. So in that respect, yes, Guantanamo has a real resonance with them. But I think, you know, the military commissions are starting to move forward. I think that this hunger strike needs to be ended one way or another. And Carol Rosenberg, who's the Miami Herald journalist who has been covering Guantanamo from the beginning, made a pretty good point on Morning Edition a couple of days ago when she said she thought that all they might need to end this hunger strike is for there to be just one of these detainees released. One of these 86 you're talking about, have them go to a third country to show that they won't be there forever in a kind of purgatory.
James in Des Moines, Iowa. James, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
I think our memory is way too short. The seeds for all of the unrest in the Middle East is sourced in the First World War, and our propping up dictators. A dictator isn't bad if they support us, but if they are not an ally of us, they're bad. That's why Syria was where it was, and that's why Iraq was an extension of Russia. We have had a great deal of reckoning for supporting the repressive Saudi Arabian regime, simply because that's where we were supposed to get our oil from.
Yeah, the history is long, and it's evident, and everybody trying to wrestle with the outcomes that we're looking at right now. Appreciate your call, James. Juliet, I want to go to healthcare. You know, we're hearing these warnings from Republicans that the implementation of the Affordable Care Act is going to be very difficult. The president himself talking about that a little bit this week. We got here was Georgia Republican Governor Nathan Deal. This was on Fox News on Tuesday, talking about, you know, here comes the Affordable Care Act and saying it's going to be a train wreck. This is becoming a kind of a mantra. Let's listen.
This was a train wreck about to happen. And even the Democrat senator who sponsored the legislation has admitted that that's probably what the future holds. It became very obvious very quickly that it was going to be a state exchange in name only, and that it was going to be dictated to us as to what we could and could not do by the federal government.
State exchange for picking up health care coverage, and of course a lot of states who had the option to do that themselves opting out, mainly Republican-led states, leaving it to the federal government. The president on Tuesday at his press conference was asked, you know, if it's going to be a train wreck by NBC's Chuck Todd. President defended the law, said, you know, look, people can complain.
Even if we do everything perfectly, there'll still be, you know, glitches and bumps, and there'll be stories that can be written that says, oh, look, this thing's, you know, not working the way it's supposed to.
Juliet Oppern, you cover the White House. What's shaping up here first around implementation? And then whatever happens with implementation, it's so big there are going to be issues. What about the politics of the rollout, Juliet?
Right. I mean, well, this is going to be one of the next political battles, and there's no question, and you put your finger on it. It's really because of so many states headed by Republican governors who have opted out, who are leaving implementation to the federal government on a scale that they hadn't prepared for. So President Obama likes to emphasize that this is really going to affect, you know, say 10% to 15% of the population, because if you already have coverage, essentially the law is implemented fully for you. But for the uninsured, this is going to be a challenge. And so that's what they're grappling with right now. They're, you know, in discussions of you know, how they can make it move as work as smoothly as possible. But Republicans have put the White House on notice. They plan to make this a signature issue in the 2014 election. And so, you know, you're both going to see a lot of criticism coming from the GOP and a real effort by Democrats to more effectively defend the law than they feel like they did in 2010.
And Juliet, what about gun legislation? You've got the NRA gathering for its big convention in a kind of a celebratory mode after background checks and much more were pushed aside on Capitol Hill. But at the same time, we're hearing a kind of rallying cry on the gun reform front saying we're going to bring legislation back. What's the dynamic on the gun issue right now, Juliet?
I think this is a fascinating political test that we're going to see in the months to come, because obviously, right, you know, I and others covered the demise of the background checks legislation a few weeks ago. And what's interesting is that both the White House and some of its allies do seem serious about keeping this issue on the table. My colleague Phil Rucker had a wonderful profile of Joe Biden today where he points out that Joe Biden is going to continue traveling and speaking on guns, something that, you know, wasn't for sure before now. We have Joe Manchin the senator, the Democratic senator from West Virginia, who is reintroducing the legislation. His colleague Pat Toomey, conservative Republican from Pennsylvania, has actually kind of called out Republicans, saying that you're not going to, that they just didn't want to give Obama a legislative win. And most interestingly, and John could speak to this, in New Hampshire, we're really seeing Senator Kelly Ayotte on, she is on the firing line right now. Sorry, no pun intended on that. But she is really being confronted by gun control advocates who are saying, why were you the only New England senator to oppose background checks? And I think she really is going to be the litmus test. If you see her willing to change her vote, that could really portend potential passage of this bill.
Jack Beattie, you're in New Hampshire. Do you see a waiver in the Kelly Ayotte corner or not? She was confronted at a town hall, but then she's been applauded by the NRA.
She has, but there are ads running several different groups against her up here, and she's lost 15 points in just a couple of weeks. She has a motive to change course.
We'll see what happens on that front and so many others. Jack Beattie, great to have you as always. Juliet Alpern with The Washington Post, thank you for joining us. And Dina Temple-Raston with NPR, counterterrorism correspondent there. Thanks to you all for being with us today. Listeners, thanks for all your comments online and for being on air. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.